Bonjour à toutes et tous. Merci pour votre présence en ce mardi après-midi qui est aussi l'après-midi du dernier épisode de ces séminaires. Nous arrivons donc au bout de la réflexion complémentaire à celle que je mène par ailleurs dans le cadre de mon cours. Et jusqu'à présent, donc, nous avons parlé de normes, nous avons aussi parlé d'autorité, mais aujourd'hui, et c'est l'intérêt, je pense, de cet après-midi, nous allons nous concentrer davantage sur la question de l'autorité en parlant des agents qui sont les porteurs de cette autorité et les modalités de fondation et d'affirmation de cette autorité religieuse. C'est pourquoi j'ai donc le grand plaisir d'accueillir d'emblée Beate Dignas, collègue de l'Université d'Oxford, donc professeur d'histoire ancienne à l'Université d'Oxford. Alors, Beate a mené son parcours universitaire en Allemagne, à Münster, si je ne m'abuse, avant d'obtenir son doctorat en histoire de l'Antiquité à Oxford. Et ce doctorat a donné lieu à la publication d'un magnifique livre qui a été publié en 2002 à Oxford University Press, intitulé « Economy of the Sacred in Hellenistic and Roman Asia Minor », qui reste un des piliers pour toute réflexion sur les questions de l'économie liée au sanctuaire à cette période et dans cette région, avec aussi, on en parlait il y a deux minutes, des pages magnifiques sur la prêtrise en Grèce ancienne, qui nous font espérer qu'à un moment ou à un autre, Beate nous donnera une belle monographie sur la question de la prêtrise. Alors évidemment, elle a publié de nombreux articles sur l'histoire grecque, sur la religion grecque, surtout aux périodes à la fin de l'époque classique et l'époque hellénistique. Et plus récemment, elle a publié différents ouvrages collectifs. En 2020... mauvaise période pour les livres, j'en sais quelque chose. A Cultural History of Memory in Antiquity. Je pense qu'une partie de ce dont elle va nous parler aujourd'hui relève de cette question de la mémoire. Un autre collectif en 2018 intitulé Wandering Myths. Et puis deux réflexions très utiles, encore une fois, pour tous ceux qui travaillent sur le personnel du culte dans le monde grec. Un ouvrage en 2013 qui s'appelle « Priests and Seers in the Religious Cultures of the Roman World » et en 2008 « Practitioners of the Divine ». Et ce sont des coéditions avec différents collègues. Donc voilà, cet éventail de publications, je pense, est très significatif des intérêts de Beate et explique pourquoi je lui ai demandé de nous rejoindre pour réfléchir ensemble sur la question de l'autorité religieuse. Beate, je te donne la parole.
Thank you very much, Vincian. Thank you very much for these kind words, but also for inviting me to give this paper today. And I apologize that I'm speaking in English. I hope that's all right. There is a handout which is basically bibliographical references as, not in alphabetical order, but as they appear as I refer to them in the course of the paper. Studying Greek priests can be frustrating, especially when one wants to make statements that capture essence and have general application. The particular appears to dominate the universal, and often political context appears to explain away a religious realm. Different genre and types of sources don't seem to add up. My encouragement to persevere has in fact been Vincian. In her introduction to the Tescra volume dedicated to the personnel of cults, she assures us neither the lack of a sacerdotal class based on vocation nor the political face of Greek priesthood necessarily turn the Greek priest into a magistrate like any other. And if we keep examining and re-evaluating all types of material, with the incentive to explain the lack of congruence where it emerges, we will move towards an understanding of Greek priesthood. In this paper, I want to ask the question, did Greek priests hold a crucial role in the processes that created and controlled collective memories within and beyond their communities? Undoubtedly, religion was the central medium of public communication about identity in the ancient world. The strong emphasis on civic identity in religious contexts drew religious and social identities together. Everyday practices of social groups within Greek communities were bound together by shared religious practices that created meaningful memories through collective experiences, or were themselves part of fundamental cultural memory. Remembrance, commemoration, and memory lay at the heart of rituals. Memory media were the foundations for the formation, negotiation, contestation, and transmission of social memory. Among these, inscriptions form an important category and were themselves referred to as hypomnemata, a term that was also used to refer to remembrance days, memorials, monuments, dedications, honorary statues, and crowns. The physical demarcation of sacred space, the monumentality of altars and temples, the placing of votives in sanctuaries created a memory landscape that was of paramount importance for the ancient worshipper and viewer and society at large. Sanctuaries were indeed lieux de mémoire. Given their core activities as managers of sanctuaries and the rites that took place within them, a priests and memory focus is an obvious one, and it is surprising that the question has not been asked much, let alone in an assessment of priestly authority and priestly agency vis-à-vis religious norms. The reasons for this seem to me to be the following. Firstly, it is once more our understanding of the embeddedness of Greek religious practice in the political realm of the polis that cautions us. Religious norms that created collective memories were produced by political institutions, and the agents in this process, in these processes, were citizens, not priests. The second reason, linked to the first, is the observation that Greek religion was not a religion in which the knowledge of sacred texts that regulated orthodox religious practices was firmly in the hands of priests and scribes. In Egypt and Babylonia, which we tend to use as examples, priests and scribes, in mostly inherited roles, had exclusive access and therefore control over the creation and preservation of cultural memories. In contrast, Greek religion was a religion in which neither dogmatic sacred texts nor privileged understanding of ritual practices existed. These are caveats that I do not want to ignore, but it looks to me as if neither prohibits a role of priesthood in processes of memory creation and control. In fact, I would like to show that the Greek civic priest was a privileged agent in the formulation of ritual norms, that a special priestly access to tradition and memory did exist, and that precisely sharing this knowledge was a means of steering collective memories. In order to do so, I want to look at the following. To what extent did priesthood convey agency and authority in the formulation and observation of regulations about religious matters? And secondly, how were priests involved in the creation of what John Dillery has termed sacred histories? This is the beginning of an inscription from Halicarnassos. It was decided at the proposal of son of Aristocles to transfer from the old stele, which stands by the statues of Poseidon Isthmios, the names of those who have been, since the time of the foundation, hereditary priests of Poseidon, whose cult was founded by those who led the colony from Troezen for Poseidon and Apollo. The lines are followed by a list of 28 priests going back to Telamon, the son of Poseidon. Adding up the number of years served by each priest. The years are given next to the priest's names in the inscription. We go back 504 years, perhaps even 827 years, if we add another list of priests from a new fragment that Sinye Izaga published in 2015. A good starting point to bring together priests, collective memory, and the crucial memory medium, epigraphy. The history of the city from its foundation, captured in priesthood, placed next to the cult statues of the god, and an interest in retaining this narrative by renewing and expanding the list. The inscription is transferred from an old stele to a new one. But, you may say, the priests are not agents here. We're dealing with a civic decree, and the priesthood is a hereditary one, not representative for Greek priesthood as such. Let me address the point of hereditary priesthood briefly. Common sense tells us that a priest appointed for life, let alone as part of family descent, can easily be interpreted as a creator and guardian of memories in the realm of sanctuary and cult, but that this is doubtful for an annual priest who was perhaps appointed by lot. Duration of office creates differences, of course, but this should not guide all investigation. André Motte, for example, makes the fascinating observation that authors such as Plato and Euripides magnify the figure of the priest in contrast to a rather banal image that we get from epigraphic sources. But he sadly hesitates to let his survey of the literary sources invite us to revise our idea of Greek priesthood because, as he says, these address idealized and lifelong priesthood. I would argue that in terms of community-wide collective memories, there is surprising overlap, and I want to focus on this overlap, the essence of priesthood, as I called it before, that both types of priesthood share. This paper cannot focus on priesthood in Plato, but one should note that even within the framework of ideal cities, Plato acknowledges what is Athenian contemporary practice, both hereditary and annual priesthoods. With regard to the medium of epigraphy, I am backed up by the fact that priest lists of annual priesthoods were displayed as regularly as those of hereditary priests in the Greek world, and that this was not linked to the priesthood being eponymous, in which case we could assign practical purposes to such lists. In fact, eponymy existed also when priests were appointed for life. It is also noteworthy that in Athens, both genos and democratic priesthoods, priests were honoured for the same services and qualities to the extent that we cannot tell from the decrees whether it was a priesthood of the one or the other type. Socioeconomic shifts in the Hellenistic period impacted both democratic and genos priesthoods, and both continued to be commemorated through inscribed votive and honorary monuments into the Roman period. Let me turn then to the important point about civic decrees. Indeed, most inscriptions concerning ritual norms set up in Greek sanctuaries stem from civic interventions. But what does that mean with regard to agency and authority? The important work on the epigraphic material formerly labelled Leges Sacrae by Maître Cabon, Mancian, and other scholars has shown that decrees and other texts stem from within a field of social negotiation of the most complex nature. As Eftichia Stavrianopoulou says, individuals and groups equipped with different sorts of symbolic capital act in a complementary yet competing fashion. We don't know who the proposer of this particular decree from Halicarnassus was, but even in the many cases where we have a name, we do not learn much about a proposer. The nature of collective decision-making required transparency with regard to agency, but also tried to negate agency because it was important that everyone, agents and audience, had the same knowledge that communication took place on equal terms. We can ask and often deduce from motivation clauses and content who had an interest in proposing a move. In this case, to not simply start a new continuing list when space ran out, but to transfer the old names and to point in the preface to the link between the city's foundation, priesthood, and identity. While the question of who had an interest may be too one-dimensional, it reminds us that civic consensus expressed in decrees and public inscriptions stands at the end of a process. Apart from the fact that this was not a straightforward process, the monument that was created could still influence and be influenced by individuals' changing views of the past. The collectively agreed narrative has an afterlife. This is what Polly Lowe observes when looking at, I quote her, the range of things the Athenians did to their inscriptions. As the text from Halicarnassus illustrates, inscriptions can be re-inscribed and the location of their display moved. Lowe concludes that collective memory is an aggregation of individual memories and memory acts rather than something centrally controlled, and that collective memory is fluid and potentially contested. Although Lowe focuses on documents relating to the 30, an exceptionally delicate situation of memory control in Athens, her conclusions have general application and, as she stresses, include forms of inscribed texts other than decrees, such as catalogues and dedications. The role of the individual matters, and there is continued interaction between individual, community, and inscribed monument. Recently, Borja Diaz-Arrigno published an article in which he uses Cicero's speeches against Verres as a rare opportunity to examine how audiences interpreted messages conveyed by the dozen inscriptions mentioned here. Distinct phases in the reception process of the epigraphic message can be identified. The role of war memorials in the direct memory of those who were alive when the statues were returned began to lose relevance, but the statues evolved into symbols of the special connection between the cities and Rome, and the restoration of the inscriptions in the imperial period turned them into a key element in the construction of the city's collective memory. So all this background to show that there are many reasons why inscribed monuments, while they strongly forged collective memories, did not, for those involved in these processes and experiencing their display, simply reflect collective agency and collectively agreed narratives of the past. But how can we detect priestly input? And to what extent can we escape the question of formal authority? A proposal reflected initiative and reasoning, but it had to be accepted by the community. Edward Harris has tried to approach Greek regulations about religious matters from the legal perspective. On first sight, the argument of priestly authority looks bleak. Religious officials act in accordance with the laws of the polis, just like other public officials, and their religious function does not give them a privileged position vis-à-vis the assembly and the courts. Harris also notes, however, that the people who drafted sacred laws invoked ta patria as the sources of authority for their proposals. And indeed, the expression kata ta patria is frequent in epigraphic texts that describe religious norms. I wonder to what extent it was a topos and what its functions and semantics were for those who used and heard it, and of course, how it related to priests. Harris goes as far as to say, I quote, all Greeks knew what ta patria was. Well, no need to define certain key terms such as thuein and thusia, sponde and spondein, pompe and pompeuein, Horkos, Ara, Ekphora, Kathairo, and Katharmos in Greek sacred regulations. And all levels had access to ta patria, even if they sometimes rely on Panhellenic shrines or local exegetes for guidance. Ta patria were, or were believed to be older than the polis. The polis did not create them. I would argue that the difference between were or were believed to matters, and that priests had a role in both. Susan Cole describes the expression as a phrase ancient administrators used when they wished to emphasize a solemn occasion or the long life and hallowed origin of a ritual. A database search shows the expression as exceptionally frequent in Athens for several centuries, but also used in Delphi, Asia Minor, and the Aegean Islands, occasionally elsewhere. It appears predominantly in the context of the worship of the gods and their sanctuaries to describe the way in which sacrifices were to be performed, offering tables arranged, priestly shares apportioned, processions conducted. Some texts use the expression katata patria in combination with the nomoi or nomima, but it is not clear whether this is in contrast or doubling of authorization. In decrees that stipulate a change with regard to religious matters, the expression indicates that everything else that takes place or is to take place as it was being done before. This would certainly include earlier legislation, but also rituals and specifications for which written evidence did not exist, not necessarily known, let alone remembered by all. It is difficult to imagine that any other than priests would, on an everyday basis, have had authority to inform about the content of ta patria, which they would have learned from previous priests and other cult personnel. Regularly, they must have improvised, implemented changes that they, as they saw fit, unless they were challenged. Our most famous instance of conflict over religious norms, katata patria, relates to the Athenian recodification of their laws in the last decade of the 5th century. In Lysias 30, Nicomachus, the nomon anagrapheus, is accused of having inscribed religious norms, especially sacrifices, that were not katata patria. The speaker says, "And how could a man show greater piety than mine when I demand, first, that our sacrifices be performed according to our ancestral rules, katata patria, and second, that they be those which tend to promote the interests of the city, and finally, those which the people have decreed and which we shall be able to afford out of the public revenue. But you, Nicomachus, have done the opposite of this by entering in your copy a greater number than had been ordained. You have caused the public revenue to be expended on these and hence to be deficient for our ancestral offerings. Tais patrios thysiais." This and further passages in the speech illustrate how difficult it was to reconstruct, differentiate, and decide between old laws, Solon's Curbes are specifically referenced, inconsistent public decrees, and surely also ritual norms that were believed to be customary, but whose legal enactment could not be proven. In most general terms, the relationship between inscriptions and their content and other sources of collective and individual memory, potentially but not necessarily written, is at stake here. When we try to imagine what and whom Nicomachus would have consulted during his 6 years that he spent on his task, publicly inscribed documents, decrees and laws, committed to perishable material, or the routine of local religious calendars, we will be taken to sanctuaries and their priests. Cities did not conduct a systematic review of their laws on a regular basis, and katata patria was probably rarely challenged. But in the same way as our speaker uses the term, the frequent references to katata patria in both epigraphic and literary sources provides its guarantor with symbolic capital, and gives reassurance to their audience that tradition was respected, that a civic intervention was taking place merely as a response to a particular situation, and that it was limited. This is a decree from Lagina, Inschriften von Stratonikeia 512, inscribed on the narrow faces of two anter blocks in the sanctuary of Fakate. Riet van Bremen has argued for the war against Aristonikos, 133 to 129 BC, but the context of the Mithridatic Wars is also possible. I want to focus on the last lines of the inscription and the expression kata ta patria here. So here are the last few lines. With good fortune, it was decided on account of this decree, everything else concerning the management in the sanctuary is to be according to both the ancestral regulations and that which has been decided before. Similarly, the inscribing of the dedications. It's not an easy document at all to understand, and of course, what was decreed follows where the stone breaks off. We also do not know, if you go back, whether there was a gap between the two fragments. I suspect not, because it would have made it a very long preamble, but we cannot be sure. But the preamble describes the power of the goddess who saved the city in serious military danger, after which it gained freedom and autonomy. In her new monograph on sacred landscapes in Hellenistic Asia Minor, Christina Williamson refers to this inscription as indicating some kind of return after a crisis to the administration of the sanctuary as it had been before, according to the traditions and earlier decrees. In my opinion, the lines acknowledge that some element of the cult was affected by the decree, but that everything else regarding the management of the sanctuary was to remain as it had always been. The prodedogmena here, in the penultimate line, is not clear and potentially important with regard to the question of whether catata patria were perceived as before the polis, as Harris called it. I think it has to refer to earlier decisions which would suggest that ta patria here stands outside the realm of polis legislation. But in any case, I think you can understand why I feel there is a blur. The reference to the inscribing of votives is curious at the end. I'd be interested to hear what you think, what's going on there, not only because it is addressed separately from the management of the sanctuary, ta ento hiero dioikumena, but also because it looks as if votives are to be inscribed after dedication systematically. Well, you may ask, where are priests in this decree? The most numerous among the inscriptions on the Lagina temple are the records of Hecate's priests in the forms of lists, personal dedications, or commemorations of priests. Altogether, 130 entries in Inschriften von Stratonikeia. Over a period of several centuries, they increasingly filled most of the interior and outer walls of the Antai. In this locale, priesthood is in your face, literally written all over the place. From the content of these inscriptions, which deserve a separate analysis as to how they write priests into the collective memories of the community, we know that priesthood meant agency and authority. And again, I cannot but imagine that it was this group that urged for this decree to refer to ta patria and to guarantee the realm of priestly management in the sanctuary at a watershed moment in the history of city and sanctuary. And this allows me to turn to my second question. How were priests involved in the creation of so-called sacred histories? John Dillery introduced this term on account of his observation that there was a distinct branch of Greek local historiography that focused on the past viewed through regional cult. Delry places his subject within Hans-Joachim Gercke's idea of intentional history, namely historiography written to articulate the identity of a given region in the Greek world and to proclaim the region's importance in a larger, changing world. Working back from the present, such treatments of the past combine myth and history and operate via subjective and conscious self-categorization. A common phenomenon is the narration and commemoration of the tradition of a sanctuary by way of recording a list of the votive offerings received over time. The most famous example is probably the so-called Lindian Chronicle or Lindian Anagraphe, and you see a photo here that I've taken from Caroline Higby's monograph. This is an almost 2.5 meter high stele that the visitor to the sanctuary would have, of course, not ignored. The set of documents inscribed on the stele in 99 BC consists of the decree that authorizes the recording of the inscription, followed by a catalogue of votive offerings going back to mythical times, and a catalogue of the goddess's epiphanies. Here you see the decree and a translation. Since the Hieron of Athena the Lindian, both the most archaic and the most venerable in existence, has been adorned with many beautiful offerings from the earliest times on account of the visible presence of the goddess, and since it happens that most of the offerings, together with their inscriptions, have been destroyed on account of time, it has been resolved, with the presumption of good fortune by the Mastroi and the Lindians, with the authorization of this decree, that 2 men be selected. Let these men, once selected, set up a stele of stone from Latos, according to what the architect writes, and let them inscribe on it this decree. Let them inscribe from the letters and from the public records and from the other evidence whatever may be fitting about the offerings and the visible presence of the goddess, making the copy of the stele with the secretary of the Mastroi, the secretary now in office. And at the end of the decree, we learn, this is also interesting, that one of the 2 men appointed is the son of the proposer of the decree. Excuse me. Many scholars have discussed and contextualized the Lindian Chronicle. We inevitably wonder about the involvement of religious officials in the execution and publication of the inventory, and about the priestly letters referred to as strong authority to confirm, in particular, the mythical dedication. So what in the decree is only called letters, you would see, I'll take you to that, are letters by 2 priests of the sanctuary. Recent studies of the Lindian Anagraphe stem from a vivid interest in local historiography. Polis Histories, Collective Memories and the Greek World is the title of Rosalind Thomas's recent monograph, in which the text looms large. But Thomas rejects Dillery's proposal of a separate subgenre of religious history. Religious practice was so central to a polis, she argues, that the material was simply part of polis histories. Her emphasis is on city tradition, collective traditions of the group, and she places the chronicle into a context of the shifting military and political situation of the Greek city-states. Thomas finds the joint citations of local historians highly striking, and I've given you, this is entry number 29, as an example. I could have chosen any other entry, but here it's very visible. So Thomas finds the joint citations of local historians highly striking because she says it presupposes that all would have had the same facts, traditions, and a similar line. And she's surprised that compilation is a virtue. She says, okay, maybe for accuracy, but she still so it's just compilation then. So here's the translation of this entry, where you can see what she means. After Herodotus, we see the local historians, Polyxalos in the fourth book. But Hieron, in the first book of his work about Rhodes, states that he also dedicated, along with the corslet, two golden statues, but then entirely confirming Hagelokos in the 11th book of his annalistic account, Aristion in the first book of his annalistic account, Aristonymus in his collection of dates, Onomastos in the first book of his annalistic account. Here we also see, in this 29th entry, again, reference to the letter of one of the two priests at the end. Even here, Rabulos himself says this in his letter to the Mastroi. Catherine Stevens also recently re-examined the Lindian Chronicle, but from a different perspective, namely as part of her cross-cultural study of intellectual life in Hellenistic Babylonia and Greece. She comments on the profiles of the almost exclusively local individuals. You see here in this entry, Herodotus is the only one who gets an ethnic, Herodotus the Turian. The others don't need ethnics. Whose writings are cited as sources. These, she argues, were local, but not parochial intellectuals, engaging creatively with pre-existing traditions, who would have enjoyed the mobility, exchange, and resources offered by a Hellenistic world of royal patronage and travelling artists. So very different interpretation from how Rosalind Thomas sees this context of local historiography. I find it important that in this light, our priests partake in a local or regional intellectual milieu alongside known and unknown local historians, including the son of the proposer of our Lindian decree, Timakidas, who becomes one of them precisely by composing the Lindian Anagraphe. Stevens sees literary scholarship as intimately connected with roles in the political and religious sphere. New connections may emerge with new Rhodian epigraphic finds that will help us to understand this local intellectual milieu even better. But the priestly cursus honorum that Rhodian prosopography and priest lists have already ascertained makes it more than likely that several of the historians named in the chronicle were at one point or the other, or over a number of years, priests in Rhodian sanctuaries. The emerging profile of members of the elite who were both interested in cultic matters and historiography applies elsewhere, and not only in the Hellenistic period. This is perhaps a daring comparison, but the attidographers Philochorus and Phanedemus come to mind. The former's religious activities most likely included roles as mantis and hieroskopos, and the latter was extremely active in the cultivation of the oracle and healing sanctuary of Amphiaraos in Oropus. But rather than seeing this as a return to the civic priest without priestly profile, I would like to highlight the access priests had to the desired information, how priests would authorize, shape, and be written into narratives of the past. Looking at priestly expertise from this perspective suggests further roles of priests as creators of collective memories, even beyond their local contexts. Hugh Bowden has suggested an interesting line of investigation by examining the connections between the various cults of Demeter Eleusinia in the Greek world. A kind of network emerges that is not based on firmly attested transfers of cult, and that shows inconsistencies with regard to cult titles, the founding genos and Eleusinian terminology of religious personnel. Bowden considers a particular category of individuals who might be described as religious experts, namely educated travelers such as Herodotus and Pausanias, who created the milieu for local founders or existing cults to feel that they were imitating the Eleusinian cult. The idea that these intellectual travelers' conversations with local priests formed a reciprocal exchange of information on the history of sanctuaries and rituals, and that their, I would say, not just antiquarian interests were shared by these, is intriguing. What, for example, do we make of Tacitus's narrative of the Eumolpid Timotheos, who spent time at the Ptolemaic court in Alexandria, reportedly in order to advise on Eleusinian rites, and who was also consulted on a recurring divine vision that the king had in relation to a cult statue of Serapis? So Tacitus says here, Ptolemy disclosed the vision of the night to the Egyptian priests, whose business it is to understand such matters. As they knew but little of Pontus, so in this dream he had dreamt that a god appeared from him to him from Pontus. As they knew but little of Pontus or of foreign countries, he inquired of Timotheus, an Athenian, one of the family of the Eumolpids, whom he had invited from Eleusis to preside over the sacred rites, what this worship was and who was the deity. But let me focus on the Lindian priests. If only we knew who Gorgosthenes and Hierobulus were, and what the form and occasion of their letters were. Were they prompted by the fire that destroyed the temple and many offerings in the early 4th century? So here are the first two entries in the catalogue of votives, where we see the first reference to Hierobulos Hiereus kai autos hyparkon enta potitus mastrus epistola. So I've got the translation here. Gorgosthenes, the priest of Athena, in his letter to the Boulay, and the second, Hierobulus himself, also a priest, in his letter to the Mastroi. And then in the following entries, this is kind of abbreviated because we know now that they are priests. It just says Gorgosthenes in his letter, Hierobulus in his letter. So Gorgosthenes appears in 12 catalogue entries, and it's all the early ones, the mythical ones. But the stone is damaged for entry 13 to 22, so we don't know whether that continued. And then the second priest appears in the first 12 as well, and then also in this entry 29 that I showed you already about the dedication of Amasis. The fact that we cannot date or identify the two priests makes it hard to propose any answer with confidence. I find it striking, however, that they are both integrated and contrasted with the list of local historians. Singled out in the decree as a specific type of evidence, listed first, and clearly with special weight. Their letters must have contained detailed records of the earliest famous dedications to the goddess. At whatever point they were sent, the council in Rhodes and the one in Lindos were informed by the expertise of these two priests, who either took the initiative or were approached by the two institutions. A priest who engaged in activities similar to the two Lindian priests is Leon, son of Chrysa, or citizen of Stratonikeia, and priest of Zeus at Palamara around the middle of the 2nd century BC. This is Inschriften von Stratonikeia 1.7. The dossier of, I will just focus on one passage, the dossier of three honorary inscriptions for the priest has primarily been interpreted towards an understanding between the Seleucid Foundation, Stratonikeia, and the Carian communities and sanctuaries that formed its building blocks. And in this context, Leon is seen by scholars as a strategic appointment by Stratonikeia to facilitate the integration of the most prominent sanctuary in the area. So what did Leon do? In the decree by the Panamares, he's praised for having made great efforts to raise the prestige of Zeus by trying to persuade the entire people to increase the splendor of the sacrifices, and then a number of individual daimoi to join in the sacrifices. and he did so with the help of extracts from historians and old documents from which he reconstructed the honours and grants of Asulia that had formerly adhered to the sanctuary, and all this enduring danger, cost and suffering. In the other two decrees, he's respectively honoured for disporting himself generously to all the citizens who came to the sanctuary and for achieving a settlement between groups that disagreed about an oath. And in a fragmentary passage, there's also reference to suppliants. Just as the two Lindian priests, Leon engaged in a process of reconstructing the history of the sanctuary, using and clearly producing material comparable to the type of evidence cited in the Lindian Anagraphae. Regardless of the political context and Leon's relationship with the individual political entities, what is praised and achieved happened via priesthood and on the basis of priestly agency and authority. In Lindos, apart from the two important priests who wrote the letters, we meet priests in the second catalogue recorded on the stele, the Epiphanes of Athena. In fact, in two of the three preserved narratives, Athena appears to priests. In Lindos, someone having been shut in secretly at night hanged himself from the supports set firmly on the wall along the back of the statue. And when the Lindians wished to send to Delphi and to ask what it was necessary to do about the incident, the goddess, standing over the priest in his sleep, commanded him to be serene about her and to lay bare off the roof that part above the statue and to leave it as is until 3 days should pass and it should be cleansed by the washings of her father, then to reconstruct the roof just as it had been before and after purifying the temple in the customary way to make a sacrifice, katata patria. And the second one, when the city was besieged by Demetrius, Callicles, having retired from the priesthood of Athena the Lindian, but still living in Lindos, believed that the goddess stood over him in his sleep to command him to announce to one of the prytanes, Anaxipolis, that he should write to King Ptolemy and should invite him to come to the aid of the city. The first time, The first time that Callicles saw the vision, he did nothing. But when the same thing happened to him repeatedly for 6 nights in a row, standing over his head, she made the same command. Then Callicles, arriving at the city, set forth these things to the council members. In both cases, a crisis generated epiphanic narratives. In the second case, even a continuum of epiphanies. The polluting suicide and the temple is of uncertain date, but the third epiphany dates to 305, of course, when Demetrius Polyarchetes attacked the city. Why a priest and a retired priest? In her excellent monograph, Divine Epiphany in Greek Literature and Culture, Yohia Petridou explores the contexts and the societal functions of divine epiphanies and observes that the many epiphanies that were motivated by a crisis, I quote, may provide authorization to a human intermediary, and that the resolution of a crisis is more commonly than not followed by the introduction of some sort of commemorative structure, for example, a festival, statues, athletic contests, or pilgrimage. The epiphanies that were embedded in civic decrees functioned as both explanatory and authority-generating tools. Petridou is convinced that the priesthood of a temple was the group whose interests most closely connected with the benefits of the epiphanies of the polis tutelary deity. Its members were invested, she says, with power, prestige, and authority, and delivered the whole community out of imminent danger. Petridou's examples are wide-ranging, from the Epidaurian Iamata, with their, as she calls it, psychological preconditioning of those practicing incubation, as well as their propagation of the cult, to the Aretologies and cults of Serapis and Isis, that feature Foundation Epiphanies, two individual priests who created epiphanic narratives to tell their community and posterity about their extraordinary synergy with the divine. In the case of the Lindyananagara Fair, the personal epiphanic experience of the priests not only gives ad hoc persuasive power, as you see, but is turned into a narrative on a watershed moment in the history of city and sanctuary. In the second epiphany, the emphasis on the former priest signals priesthood as the defining attribute when it comes to communication with the deity. What is also significant is that we're told explicitly that the epiphany was an alternative to oracular guidance. As Rosalind Thomas does, Catherine Stevens contextualizes the Lindian Chronicle within a Hellenistic imperial context in which shaping and using the past could get concrete results among cities rivaling for monarchic respect and benefaction. These outward-looking interpretations alert us to the priests as authorities for the history of the sanctuary, but they do not distinguish a priestly from a civic interest. So can we read such local histories in a different way in order to make this distinction? Let me close the circle and come back to the priests of Halicarnassus. Jeremy McInerney has just offered a fascinating new interpretation of the so-called Pride of Halicarnassus, an inscription from the mid to late 2nd century BC that is often referred to as a parallel to the Lindian Chronicle. The elegiac poem opens with an address to Aphrodite, asking the goddess, Tes Halicarnassou Totimion, what is the pride of Halicarnassus? Many scholars have commented on the inscription since it was first published in 1998, especially in the comprehensive edited volume by Izaga and Pedersen on the topic. Often the focus is on the story of the nymph Salmakis and Hermaphroditus, with a narrative that is strikingly different from the one we knew from Ovid. McInerney notes, however, that the answer given by the goddess first tells us the story of the newborn Zeus being concealed by the earthborn men of Halicarnassus, who are rewarded by being made priests and the attendants of his house. And Zeus made the sons of Gaia his honored priests who care for his awesome house. And they are, in the first line, called the illustrious crop of earthborn men. Only after these verses, Aphrodite proceeds to tell the story of the fountain, the various groups who colonized Halicarnassus, and a catalogue of famous local poets and literary figures. McInerney's analysis points to what he calls a local discourse environment in which a reconciliation of local rivalries is attempted through shared narratives. He identifies the different competing traditions, not only in terms of ethnicity, Carian and Greek, but as stemming from groups of priests. So after the Carian priests, in lines 31 to 42 of the inscription, we also see the Antheadai addressed from Troezen. Here it is Anthes, the son of Poseidon. Remember, in our priest list, it was another son of Poseidon, Telamon. So in a way, a slightly different version, but we clearly see the same lineage here addressed. And these were the family that held the hereditary priesthood of Poseidon in Halicarnassus. So I find this contrasting inward-looking interpretation of the text intriguing. Daniel Tober has rightly emphasized how important it was for the authors and local recipients of local historiography to imply an external audience, in fact, to pretend that the local community was excluded by, for example, not using terms such as ancestors and fatherland, and certainly by referring to protagonists in the third person. Yet the local community was the target audience. The local author, as Tober argues, was able to authorize an idiosyncratic version of the past through which he might reject elements of the politeia or validate the status quo, all the while justifying his own behavior and confirming his membership in and even leadership of the community whose cultural memory he was purporting to inscribe. You can see where I'm heading. I would argue that priests were in the perfect position to be and steer such authors. So these points here might be the gist of what I've tried to argue. I wanted to positively engage with the idea that priests were just like other members of the elite, but to show that as priests, they had an invested and accepted role in the civic processes that led to the formulation and articulation of ritual norms. They appeared in and used the powerful memory medium, epigraphy, to steer collective memories. Priests' strong link with their sanctuary as lieu de mémoire for the whole community mattered. Here, they were regularly seen as agents and authority by the community, as procuring the success of sacrifice, as imitating and sharing with the deity, as supervising the display of votives. Here, they had privileged access to local history and identity, as favored members of a local intellectual elite with strong interests in local history. They were able to write themselves into collective memories as narrators of epiphanic narrative, of priest lists, as authority with regard to what was catata patria. And I think that all this should be considered in the semantics of Greek priesthood. Thank you.